From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The war in the Gulf has created its share of strange bedfellows. Perhaps the most unusual alliance is the one between Syria and the coalition forces. On this edition of Fresh Air, we examine Syria's motives in the war with Patrick Seale, author of a biography of Syrian President Hafez al-Assad. Also, we look at the concept of the just war with military historian Sir Michael Howard. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the first songs for and against the war in the Gulf. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A British pool report from the Saudi warfront said today that Allied warplanes have been bombing a 10-mile column of Iraqi armored vehicles heading for Saudi Arabia. Senior U.S. military officials have refused to comment on reports that between 800 and 1,000 Iraqi tanks were moving toward the front. In Washington, Army General Thomas Kelly said that if Iraq does bring its forces out of its fortifications, it will just make them vulnerable to Allied air power. A British correspondent quoted intelligence reports as saying that more than 100 Iraqi tanks have been destroyed in fighting along the Saudi-Kuwaiti border. The Saudis declared victory in Kafji today after more than 2 days of fighting with Iraqi troops and tanks in the Saudi border town. While Saudis and Qatari troops fought building to building, American air power supported the operation. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
American Marine Harrier jets took on Iraqi tanks today on the border of Kuwait and near the Saudi border town of Khafji. There were so many jets in the air that some pilots said there weren't enough targets to go around. Lieutenant Colonel Dick White is a U.S. Marine pilot.
It's like someone turned the kitchen light on late at night and the cockroaches started scurrying. Finally got them out where we can find them and we're killing them.
Reports today that Iraq is massing tanks on the border is welcome news to these pilots. There's been concern that Saddam Hussein would keep his tanks in protective sand berms. Running them to the border puts them in target range of overwhelming American air power. In Saudi Arabia, this is Deborah Amos.
A top official from the French Foreign Ministry left for Tehran today for talks with Iranian leaders. A delegation from Baghdad, led by Iraq's first deputy prime minister, is also visiting the Iranian capital. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The official Iranian news agency said delegations from Iraq, Algeria, Yemen, and France would be in Tehran for peace talks. The French Foreign Ministry denied it was launching another peace initiative. A government official said François Cher, the Secretary General of the French Foreign Ministry, was going to Iran as part of France's efforts to maintain relations with countries in the Middle East. Earlier this month, Cher visited Oman, and he's also held talks in Tunisia, Libya, Morocco, and Algeria. The French Foreign Ministry said Cher did not have a mandate to talk to the Iraqis during his 24-hour stay in Tehran. It said Cher would discuss the war with Iranian leaders and would also ask them why dozens of Iraqi planes have sought refuge in Iran. Cher is expected to ask Tehran to stay neutral in the Gulf War. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Stock prices were up again today on Wall Street, helped along by good earnings reports from a number of companies and a growing belief that the U.S. recession will be short and shallow. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 23 points to close at 2,736.39. Advances led declines by a margin of 2-1 in heavy trading of 204 million shares. This is NPR News. There was renewed factional fighting in South Africa's Natal province today, just a day after the country's major anti-apartheid leaders called for peace. Police said that 8 people were killed and dozens injured in fighting between supporters of the African National Congress and the Zulu Inkatha Party. ANC leader Nelson Mandela and Inkatha president Mangosuthu Buthelezi issued a joint peace call after a lengthy meeting yesterday. Mandela, on a visit to Namibia today, told reporters that it would take time to spread the peace message throughout the country. One of 4 people being held hostage by Colombian drug traffickers has been found dead in Bogota. A morgue physician today identified the body of Marina Montoya, the sister of a former government secretary. Leslie Werpsa reports.
The body of 65-year-old Montoya was found a week ago in Bogota and buried without being identified. A judge saw Montoya's photograph on television and later ordered the exhumation of the corpse. Montoya had been shot 6 times. Her brother, Germán Montoya, was general secretary to former President Virgilio Barco. He had attempted to act as a contact for negotiations between drug traffickers and the government. On Wednesday, drug traffickers using the name The Extraditables said that they had ordered Montoya's execution, but they claimed that the order had been given on Friday, shortly after another hostage, journalist Diana Turbay, was killed, apparently by her captors, when police raided the ranch where she was being held. It is not clear if Montoya's murder will cause the government to retract on its policy to allow the drug traffickers to surrender, confess, and be tried in Colombia instead of being extradited. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Werpsa in Bogota.
Federal health officials reported today that more than 400,000 Americans now die each year from smoking. The Centers for Disease Control noted that more Americans are quitting smoking and said the high death rate is striking people who began smoking in the 1950s and 60s. The report said that more than 430,000 Americans died from smoking in 1988. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The U.S. State Department has long accused Syria of harboring Palestinian terrorists, including the ones thought to be responsible for the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. Syria's president, Hafez al-Assad, is a dictator who has been one of the Arab world's harshest critics of the U.S. and its support of Israel. Now the U.S. and Syria are working together to stop Saddam Hussein, a longtime rival of Hafez al-Assad. Less than 3 years ago, Iran and Iraq were engaged in a brutal war. Now it appears they're making amends. Their opposition to Israel and the United States may be taking precedence over whatever differences they had that led to 8 years of war and over a million casualties. The current war in the Middle East is creating some strange bedfellows, as countries who were once mortal enemies now find themselves on the same side. Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet spoke about these shifting alliances with Patrick Seale, a British writer who is the author of two books about Syria, including a recent biography of Hafez al-Assad.
Even though Syria and Iraq have had a long history of bad relations, they actually have a lot in common. Can you tell us what the two countries have in common politically?
Well, what they have in common is they're ruled by a party of the same name, but that's about as far as one can go, because that party split in 1966, and the two countries are ruled by rival wings of the same party. I would say there's one fundamental thing to bear in mind, which explains the differences between them. Iraq has, over the last decade, been fighting Iran, and it sees its enemy as Iran, or at least it did until this recent crisis. Whereas Syria, of course, has been always looking over its shoulder at Israel and sees Israel as the main enemy. And so they couldn't really agree on who was the main enemy. That was really the fundamental difference. Of course, Iraq wanted Syria to join it in the war against Iran, and Syria wanted Iraq to join it in the war against Israel. So that was a fundamental difference, quite apart from sort of personal antagonism between the two, and a lot of blood between them, a lot of attempts at sabotage, terrorism, and to unseat each other. In each capital, there's a sort of Trojan horse or shadow cabinet of the other. So there are many, many points of dispute. But nevertheless, it is a dispute between brothers.
Tell me more about the Ba'ath Party. Saddam and Assad both head up different factions of the Ba'ath Party, and they're both secularists, they're both Arab nationalists. Can you tell us more about the Ba'ath Party?
Yes, in a nutshell, this was a party founded in the late 40s in Syria by two schoolmasters, a Christian, and a Michel Aflaq, and a Muslim, Salah al-Din Bitar. And it was essentially a party which appealed to students, to young people. And the main idea about it, putting it in the simplest terms, was that the Arab world at that time was in a very powerless state. It had been occupied by the Turks for 400 years, then by the British and the French. It had failed to resist the onslaught of Zionism. The Israelis had been able to set up their state on Arab territory. And so generally, Arabs felt that their fortunes were at a very low ebb. And so this party, and its name in Arabic means rebirth or renaissance, it was an attempt to rally Arab forces and on a program of reform, revolution, rebirth. Now, it's mainly thought of as a pan-Arab party in the sense that they believed that salvation for the Arabs lay in frontier smashing, in forming a single big Arab power able to stand up both against the Jews on the one hand and, of course, the Western powers on the other.
When Assad and Saddam each speak of this Arab nation, could you describe the vision that each of them holds of this type of Arab nationalism?
Well, this, Amy, is a very contentious question, because though many Arabs believe that there is something called an Arab order, that there is something called an Arab nation, and of course the various Arab states have much in common, the language, religion, common history, common culture, and so forth. Nevertheless, the Arab world is divided into nation states, and these nation states have very different national interests and have very often been at odds with each other. So you can't say that there is such a thing as an Arab consensus. One thing has united them, and that was opposition to Israel and support for the Palestinians. But even there, it has to be qualified, because frequently national state interests were opposed to Palestinian interests. Individual states, anxious to protect themselves against Israeli retaliation, often acted as a brake on Palestinian activism. And so it's very hard to say that there was ever anything called an Arab consensus. And that's why, of course, the Arab League was toothless, as it was proved to be in this last crisis.
So do you think that Assad and Saddam each hope for this one united Arab-speaking world for the betterment of the Arabs, or is their main concern more that they be the leader of this type of Arab nation?
You see, this notion now of a single Arab nation has really gone out of fashion, and it's been out of fashion for a very long time. In fact, one can ask whether it was ever more than just a gleam in the eye of the Ba'ath Party founders. The man who is normally thought of as the great Arab leader of modern times was, of course, President Nasser of Egypt. Now, he didn't believe in this notion of one single Arab state. His idea of Arab unity was Arab solidarity. He wanted Arab states to pile in behind Egypt in its conflicts with the powers. And that, in a sense, I would say, is much more the idea which is still current in the Arab world today. But if one should add to that, that individual Arab states have competed for leadership in the region. And of course, I prefer to look at it as if the Middle East is an interlocking system of states. Now, at different times, different states have sought the leadership of this system. For example, Egypt under Nasser did try and dominate the whole system and force everybody to toe the Egyptian line. Then, for example, Israel tried to lead the whole system, to dominate it, sought hegemony after the 67 war, and then particularly after the 82 invasion of Lebanon. Then we get Iran under the Ayatollah, again sought to dominate the whole system and had to be contained. Each one of these parties, Egypt was contained, then Israel was to some extent forced back out of Lebanon, then Iran was contained by the Gulf War. Now we have Iraq making its bid for leadership, and it in turn, so the other players say, has to be contained.
My guest is Patrick Seal. He's written a biography of the president of Syria called Assad, and he also has an earlier book called The Struggle for Syria. When the Shah of Iran was overthrown and Khomeini took over in Iran, and he established a revolutionary Islamic State. And at that time, Assad established an alliance with Iran. But there are many contradictions in that alliance, and he was criticized by other Arab countries for forming this alliance with Iran. And why? What are some of the problems there?
Well, you see, first of all, a fundamental principle of Arab nationalism, which President Nasser of Egypt had advanced, was that the Arabs should unite only among themselves. Arabs should unite only with Arabs. That's how President Nasser put it. And so it caused a bit of a shock in the Arab world when Syria, which considered itself a prime champion of Arab nationalism, allied itself with a non-Arab state, Iran, against its Arab neighbor, Iraq, in the Gulf War. Now, of course, President Assad of Syria prides himself on his foresight, and he believes that events have often proven him right. And in this case, I think with some justice, he felt he was right. And his argument was this. His argument was that the Iran of the Ayatollahs was a very different species, a very different creature from the Shah's Iran. The Shah's Iran was tied up with the United States, was Israel's ally, whereas The Shah of the Ayatollahs was a non-aligned country. It wanted to help the Arabs. It would have been a very useful ally for them in the struggle against Israel. And that's why one of the reasons why Assad allied himself with Iran. And he criticized, bitterly criticized Saddam Hussein at that time for what he considered the wrong war against Iran at the wrong time and against the wrong enemy.
So Iran was opposed to Israel, but Iran was also a revolutionary Islamic state. And didn't that threaten Assad's vision of a secular secularism that he was promoting in his country?
Well, it should also be remembered on the religious front that President Assad is a member of a small Shiite sect, or a sect derived from Shiism, which, as you know, is, of course, the sect dominating in Iran. And so one could argue that there was a sort of sectarian link between Tehran and Damascus, which extended even to the Shiite populations of Lebanon. So on that front, I think it's probably a mistake to say what a strange thing it is that a secular power like Syria should unite with a theocratic power like Iran. It's more a question, really, of state interests dictating the alliance. What the Syrians did was to bring Iran into the heartlands of Arab politics in a way it never had been before. Under the Shah, Iran was very much a marginal power, whereas perhaps thanks to Assad, Iran has really entered Arab politics, and we are seeing that today very much with Iran emerging as perhaps one of the arbiters of the post-war situation in the Gulf region.
Well, do you think that the revolutionary Islamic movement threatens Assad's vision in any way of what he hopes to achieve with Syria?
I don't think so at the moment, except in this sense, that this present conflict in the Gulf is arousing very violent feelings in the Arab and Muslim worlds at the popular levels. And of course, Assad, from that point of view, is on the wrong side. He's on the Allied side. And he's in a rather uncomfortable position there. I mean, you may have noticed just in the last few days that, for example, the chief of staff of the Pakistan Army, now, he has come out very strongly against this war and against the Allies. He said this is an imperialist and Zionist war being waged against Muslims. In Morocco, there's been a general strike against the war. And right around the Arab and Muslim world, there have been protests and indeed acts of terrorism addressed at Western interests. And so this, of course, puts Assad in a rather embarrassing position. And every time that Saddam Hussein manages to lob a scud at Israel, popular opinion in Syria puts pressure on Assad to change camps. Now, he's not going to change camp, because if he were to defect from the coalition, if he were to take a small step towards Saddam, he would risk being attacked by Israel. Israel might seize what it considered a historic chance to destroy Syria's military potential, just as the Allies were destroying Iraq's, which of course would allow Israel to reign supreme in the region. And Assad is not going to give Israel that opportunity. So in a sense, the Syrian position is rather like a mirror image of Israel's. Israel is being handsomely rewarded for staying out of the war. Assad hopes to be rewarded for staying inside the coalition.
So you think that even if Israel does retaliate against Iraq, that Syria will not withdraw from the coalition?
Amy, it very much depends on the scale of the Israeli response. Let's imagine that in desperation, Saddam Hussein were to launch a Scud armed with a chemical warhead at Israel. Now, if that were to happen, I would anticipate a very powerful Israeli response. They've more or less said so. Now, if that were to happen, say a massive assault with conventional or unconventional weapons against Iraqi population centers, then I think it would be impossible for countries like Syria to stay out. Indeed, I would anticipate that both Syria and Iran might come in on the side of Iraq. Indeed, you may have noticed that quite recently, in the last few days, Syria's vice president and foreign minister paid a visit to Tehran, clearly to coordinate their strategies in the event of a massive Israeli attack on Iraq. Then, of course, we have this rather fascinating development of all these Iraqi planes which have landed in Tehran, at Iranian air bases.
What do you think is going on with those planes?
Well, I think what we can say is that they've gone there by design rather than by defection, that there's obviously been some prior arrangement between Baghdad and Tehran. I learned just today from my Iranian sources a number of interesting things. First, that these Iraqi planes are actually exercising inside Iran. Their pilots are flying them in Iran on a regular basis. Secondly, I'm told that the Iranians, as I was talking today to Tehran, to an Iranian intelligence source, he told me something very fascinating. And the President Saddam's wife and children were in Iran and not in Tanzania, as has been generally reported. And also that the families of several Iraqi ministers had also taken refuge in Iran. Now, this tells us a lot, I think, about Iran's present position. In this conflict, Iran and Iraq, so recently bitter enemies, now have a number of common interests. One of their interests is to prevent a victorious United States lording it over the Gulf region. Neither of them want a permanent Western military presence in their backyard. Another common interest Iraq and Iran have is to contain Turkey. They are both frightened that Turkey might help itself to part of an enfeebled Iraq. It might, for example, try and seize the oil-bearing province of Mosul. And so this conflict has brought Iran and Iraq closer together.
My guest is Patrick Seal, author of Assad, The Struggle for the Middle East. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Patrick Seal, author of Assad, The Struggle for the Middle East. Could you play out a scenario for us about what you think will happen with Syria once the fighting stops?
President Assad is, I think, very concerned about the post-war order. Of course, there's been a lot of speculation about what that order might be. But if you look at it from his point of view, what does he see? He sees a shattered and enfeebled Arab world, with Iraq largely destroyed and certainly not able to give him the sort of help he might expect in a war against Israel. He sees a victorious United States. He sees an Israel whose strategic environment has been fundamentally improved by the destruction of Iraq. And he sees a Palestinian movement in grave disarray because its leaders have been foolish enough to tie their fortunes to Saddam's wagon. And so in such a post-war situation, the balance of power is overwhelmingly on the side of the United States and Israel. And so this is a subject of much concern for President Assad. So what has he tried to do? He's tried to improve his relations with Saudi Arabia and Egypt, two allies of the United States. He's tried to form a sort of axis with them. And he's tried to impress on the United States, in his meetings with James Baker, in his meeting with President Bush last November, that there can be no stable settlement in the Middle East unless Syria's interests are addressed, that favoring Israel is simply inviting the Arabs to retaliate, and that the Palestine problem must be solved whether or not Yasser Arafat is the right man to represent the Palestinians. This is the sort of message he's been putting across.
Among the masses in the Middle East, do they tend to be Islamic revolutionaries?
I think it's a grave mistake to imagine that the Arab world is made up of Islamic fanatics or Islamic revolutionaries. This is definitely not the case. Arabs are very often pious. There's a great deal of piety in the region. Religion still means a great deal to them in a way that it doesn't really mean very much to many people in the Western world. Now, In addition to that, one should say that in many countries, particularly those countries without proper political institutions or democratic forms of government, Islam has become a vehicle for protest, for social, economic, and political protest. And in many Arab countries, wanting to protest against the incompetence of their leaders and the incompetence of the national regimes under which they've lived for many years, who failed, as they would see it, to solve some of the fundamental problems of the Middle East, notably in the confrontation with Israel, then under such circumstances you get a growth of Islamic activism. But this is a political movement and should not be thought of in terms of every inhabitant of those countries being a sort of Islamic revolutionary.
Patrick Seale has written several books on the Middle East, including a recent biography of Hafez al-Assad. When you were working on your biography of Assad, you were given unprecedented access to him. How were you able to spend time with him? What kind of access did you have? Did he prescribe certain limits on what you could ask or what he would talk about?
I first met Assad in 1977. He'd admired my earlier book, which you were kind enough to mention, The Struggle for Syria, and he had recommended it to some of his cadres, and indeed it had been translated into Arabic. And it was at that stage that he suggested rather playfully that I should write a second volume. But I didn't feel ready to do that, and not enough had happened, as it were. And then when he fell ill in 1984, I thought I'd better hurry up, otherwise I might miss the chance. And so I went back to Syria and contacted him. And I had a whole series of meetings with him then over the years, from 84 or 85 onwards, right up to 88. And I must say, he proved a very easy man to interview, except that most of the our meetings were held very late at night, and I was sort of dying with fatigue. But he showed extraordinary resilience. He put no restrictions on what I could ask him. In fact, he repeatedly said to me that he didn't want to influence me one bit. But of course, when the book finally appeared, I was very sorry to see that he banned it in Syria. It's not allowed on sale in Syria. And one has to conclude that though the book was generally favorable to him, I would say, and that I tried to explain his policies, it wasn't perhaps the 100% endorsement which he might have liked.
He's known for supporting terrorists and taking very vengeful action against his enemies. When you sat down to write the book, did this cross your mind at all? Did you fear that something might happen to you if you wrote the wrong thing?
Not at all. And I think his reputation as a terrorist has been largely overplayed, I would say, by his enemies, who have an interest in labeling him as such. I mean, the Middle East is a tough place. I don't think that any state in the region can claim to occupy the moral high ground. Every state in the region, Iraq, Israel, Syria, Jordan, have all got tough security services. They're all very similar, as a matter of fact, in the way they treat their prisoners, in the hit teams they send out, and so forth.
What kind of man is Assad? Could you describe him for us?
Well, Assad is a very cerebral figure. He's a self-taught intellectual. He's as different as you can imagine from the rash, vainglorious Saddam Hussein. His passion is grand strategy, and he plots his moves with very quiet and rather ponderous deliberation. He's a cautious man. He's a loner. His favorite instrument of government is the telephone. He seems to shun human contact.
Patrick Seale, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Amy.
Patrick Seale spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Chicago band named Artistic Feet sent us this song. The war is only 2 weeks old, but songwriters are already making their statements for and against it. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new pro and anti-war records by Randy Newman, Hank Williams Jr., and others. And we talk with military historian Sir Michael Howard, who wants to remind Americans in the peace movement that although war is a horrible and bloody business, it is sometimes necessary. He's the author of a book on war and the liberal conscience. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Some U.S. military officers in Saudi Arabia are reporting increased Iraqi troop movements along the border with Kuwait. NPR's David Mopus says the Pentagon has little to say about these reports.
Pentagon officials neither confirm nor deny the reports of convoys moving south toward Saudi Arabia, saying to do so might compromise U.S. intelligence sources. But Allied commanders say they would welcome more offensives like the one Iraq waged against Kafji. General Thomas Kelly says if they come out of their fortifications, they'll be sorry, because the Allies can optimize their air power advantage. He said U.S. warplanes destroyed 42 Iraqi tanks and 35 other vehicles in the Kafji battle and took 161 Iraqi soldiers prisoner. He called their attack a pretty shabby effort. If Iraq launches more offensives, officials say, it will not draw the Allies into a premature ground war, but that the Allies do have plans for counterstrikes. I'm David Malpas at the Pentagon.
In a pool report from the Persian Gulf War, a British correspondent says that Allied warplanes have been bombing a 10-mile column of Iraqi armor heading for Saudi Arabia. The report said the fighting covers a front stretching from the Persian Gulf coast near Kafji to the point where the frontiers of Kuwait, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia meet, a distance of some 155 miles. Iran has given its strongest indication yet that Iraqi warplanes that have landed there will be kept there until the war is over. The Pentagon says that there are at least 98 Iraqi planes in Iran. Mike Theodulu has more from Nicosia.
A high-level Iraqi delegation is in Tehran with a message from Saddam Hussein to Iran's President Rafsanjani. There's no word on the contents, but if Saddam's asking for his planes back, he could well be disappointed. According to the official Iranian news agency, Iran's foreign minister, Ali Akbar Velayati, told the Iraqi delegation, headed by the deputy prime minister, Sadoun Hamadi, that Saddam should have asked Iran's permission before sending in his planes. Iran was neutral, Velayati insisted, and would keep the planes till the war was over. There's been some suspicion in the West that Iran had struck a deal with Iraq before the war began, to give its planes and Iraq's elite Republican Guards forces safe haven if the need arose. But some Iranian sources say Iran was so surprised when the first Iraqi warplanes arrived that it shot down a few. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
After a lull of 2 days, Iraq launched another missile attack on Israel today. According to Israeli officials, only one missile struck the northern edge of the occupied West Bank this evening, and there were no casualties or damage. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 23 points to close at 2,736.39 on volume of some 204 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. In Washington, the FBI has warned that the threat of terrorism will continue after the Persian Gulf War is over. The head of the FBI's anti-terrorism effort says that the nation's high alert against terrorism will continue for a long time, because of a long-term threat of Iraqi-inspired terrorism. Assistant FBI Director William Baker says terrorist incidents overseas have been somewhat slower than predicted, but appear to be on the increase. New State Department figures show that there have been some 70 incidents of terrorism directed against countries which have taken up arms against Iraq. George Guetta reports from the State Department.
The 70 incidents add up to an average of almost five a day. The attacks have resulted in property damage, but there have been only a few casualties. The State Department says it is not clear how many of these attacks were sponsored by Iraq. The only incident in which Iraqi nationals were discovered to have been directly involved occurred in the Philippines 2 weeks ago. The State Department says that just in the past day there have been terrorist attacks in Yemen, Peru, Jordan, the Philippines, Chile, and Lebanon. In each case, the target was an installation identified with a country aligned against Iraq. Meanwhile, the FBI says the terrorism threat, both at home and abroad, will continue long after the fighting stops in the Gulf. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
The government of Jordan has announced new restrictions on driving and the heating of government buildings. In an effort to save energy supplies, officials say that cars will be driven on alternate days beginning next week. The government's driving pool will be cut in half, and the heating of government buildings will be cut by 25%. Since last September, Jordan has been receiving all of its crude oil from Iraq. In Amsterdam, officials of KLM Royal Dutch Airlines say the international service will be cut because of fewer passengers due to the Persian Gulf War. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
There. In a little while, we talk to the eminent military historian Sir Michael Howard. The war in the Gulf is affecting the playlists of rock and roll radio. It's giving new life to old songs like Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, The Shirelles' Soldier Boy, and Show Me the Way by Styx. There's also new pro and anti-war songs and remakes of old ones. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of some of them.
One, two, three, and...
Everybody's talking about
planet Earth, rebirth,
United Nations,
good relations,
space station, starvation,
radiation,
salvation,
education, liberation,
oh, and we don't
all
stop.
We are saying, is
the new version of John Lennon's Give Peace a Chance was overseen by Lennon's son Sean and Lenny Kravitz, a musician whose debut album last year often sounded like Sgt. Pepper in a blender. They rounded up more than 30 singers, including Bonnie Raitt, Tom Petty, LL Cool J, and Peter Gabriel. This version of the song is earnest and energetic, but it lacks a couple of things. One is timeliness. In its present context, Give Peace a Chance means give sanctions a chance. Lenny Kravitz has said as much in interviews. But the time of sanctions is past, people are fighting, and in this sense, peace was given the briefest of chances and lost. As a piece of music, this all-star effort also lacks the tension that was provided in the original by John Lennon's voice. However much you might agree with its sentiment, the lyric and melody of this song are, you have to admit, hopelessly sappy. John Lennon's sharp nasal voice gave his Give Peace a Chance the sting of irony, a thin coating of bitterness that let you know he doubted the world would give peace a chance. That's the entirely appropriate message for 1991 that's missing in this new version.
Cancer cells
from the sun.
Middle East crazy bees.
Rock and rollers sing for peace.
Country music and its audience have long been receptive to the kind of blunt sloganeering that can seem corny in rock or pop. Heartfelt corniness is, in fact, one of country music's great strengths. Months before the Persian Gulf War erupted, Hank Williams Jr. was sizing up popular opinion and giving it his usual aggressive twist. He came up with this, the brutally jingoistic, "Don't Give Us a Reason."
Hey, old Saddam, you figured wrong when you thought the whole world would back down and let you take all the oil and rape Kuwait and plunder and spoil. Let sleeping dogs lie, don't give us a reason. 'Cause people in the USA are not really afraid of your starving army and all your wore-out tanks. And if you take some innocent lives, that's when the fur's gonna really fly. Hey man, back off and get smart. Don't give us a reason. Don't give us a reason to come gunning for you. 'Cause the odds don't look so good and your neck is in a noose. 'Cause the eagle and the bear make a mighty strong pair. And my advice is don't give them a reason.
It's interesting to note that this song did not soar to the top of the charts. This may have to do with the fact that it's a pretty crude stab at a novelty hit, but I also think there's something else at work here. The country music audience is often stereotyped as innately conservative, but like any other mass audience, there's actually a wide array of opinions about any issue. That may be why more subtle country songs that aren't as overtly pro or anti-war have become popular. I'm thinking of songs like Waylon Jennings' The Eagle and this one, a big hit from Aaron Tippin, called You've Got to Stand for Something.
Now, Daddy didn't like trouble, but if it came along, everyone that knew him knew each side that he'd be on. He never was a hero for this county's shining light, but you could always find him standing up for what he thought was right. He'd say, you've got to stand for something, or you'll fall for anything. You've got to be your own man, not a puppet on a string. Never compromise what's right and uphold your family name. You've got to stand for something, or you'll fall for anything.
There's an artful ambivalence in that song that makes it easy to rally around. Aaron Tippin, Hank Williams Jr., and Sean Lennon all in their various ways want to comfort and reassure their audiences. Only one new song about the war wants to unsettle its listeners. That's Randy Newman's Lines in the Sand. Newman isn't giving interviews about the song. He says he wants its message to speak for itself. But his record label, Warner Brothers, has said he recorded it the night the war began. As you'll hear, it's a lovely piece of music whose simple instrumentation suggests that Newman watched PBS's Civil War series and was influenced by the period music he heard there. While its melody is soothing, Lines in the Sand fully conveys Newman's real feelings about this war in a way no pop song has so far.
Deep in the desert, evening draws night. Brave sons and daughters look to the sky. The blood of these children, a stain on the land. If they died to defend some lines in the sand.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. This is Fresh Air. Earlier this week, military historian Sir Michael Howard had an op-ed piece in the New York Times that struck us. He's a professor of military and naval history at Yale. He taught at Oxford University for 20 years. His many books include Studies in War and Peace, War and the Liberal Conscience, and The Causes of War. His op-ed piece was about the much-quoted 1831 book On War by the Prussian officer Karl von Clausewitz. Howard translated the book into English. In the op-ed piece, he quoted Clausewitz as saying, "The fact that a bloody slaughter is a horrifying act must make us take war more seriously, but not provide an excuse for gradually blunting our swords in the name of humanity. Sooner or later, someone will come along with a sharp sword and hack off our arms." Howard thinks it's important to remind Americans that war, however horrible, is sometimes necessary.
If you're decide that you're not going to go to war at all, ever, you do rather put yourself at the mercy of people who are prepared to go to war, who are prepared to inflict and suffer those losses. And so if one is going ultimately either to defend oneself or to defend one's values or to defend one's friends or to defend the resources necessary for one's survival, there has got to be at the bottom line a willingness, if necessary, to fight and if necessary, to suffer. And by suffering, it does mean people getting killed. And so I'm afraid what Clausewitz then said applies as much now as it ever did.
I'm wondering what your response is now to the American peace movement. Do you think that the movement is informed at all by a response against war that is unrealistic?
Well, there are various elements in the peace movement. There is the absolute Christian pacifist tradition, which says that the use of force under any circumstances is immoral and contrary to the teaching of Christ. Therefore, whatever the temptations and whatever the difficulties, we will not fight. Well, that is an attitude which one cannot but respect, but it does really mean we're contracting out of international political life. The next element is that which says we can settle this without fighting. Why did we not stand back and allow sanctions to bite for longer? Why did we not simply confine ourselves to the protection of Saudi Arabia and let Kuwait go? Why is it necessary to invade Iraq at all? Well, all those seem to me to be perfectly understandable, legitimate, and defensible positions. Perhaps the decision to go to war was taken prematurely. I myself don't believe that it was, but I have sympathy for those who do think so. But once it has been taken, you are then in a rather different ballgame. Because, as Clausewitz said, war is a contest of wills. And the more Hussein perceives that the American public are not united behind the war, the more he sees that there is a powerful element which wants to bring it to a halt, the more he is likely to feel that it is worth his while to go on stalling, to go on fighting, and to go on deterring us and frightening us. And therefore, the longer the war is likely to last. And that is why, although I have deep sympathy and I think understanding with the peace movement, I fear very much that their activities could be prolonging the war rather than bringing it to a halt.
So you think that the people's support is a very important part of any war campaign, and that opposition can really hurt the cause. Of course, one of the things that really complicates this in America is this kind of deep-seated suspicion of governmental motives. I mean, after deceit from Vietnam and Watergate and Iran-Contra, I think there are a lot of people who wonder, what is this war really about? What are the motives that America really has that they're perhaps not stating directly as their motives? So how do you, in your thought of the importance of public support, take into account this fear of being deceived and misled by the government who's waging the war?
I think it's understandable, and I think the track record of certain American governments has not been at all good. But I just remind your listeners, this is not just an American war. You have a large number of allies and associates that you have got fighting beside you in the desert. You've got Saudi Arabians, and you have, if I may say so, British. And the British are as convinced about the necessity for this war as you are. And if the American government has done a snow job, as it were, on their own people, they have not done it on us. They have not done it on the United Nations. They succeeded in getting a virtual unanimous vote from the United Nations, including a number of extremely suspicious and reluctant allies and others, to go along with the idea that this war is necessary. It is not a war just for American interests. It's a war for world interests. And world interests for two reasons. First, that we are trying to establish, slowly and not very successfully, a world order in which it will not be safe for large nations to attack and to digest and to destroy their small neighbors. Secondly, I know people say that this is a war only for oil, but only for oil. It's like saying it's a war only for air, only for oxygen. Oil is not simply a matter of the price of gas at the pumps, and it is not a matter simply of the profits of oil companies. It's a matter of the survival of the whole of the industrialized world. A threat that oil supplies are going to get into the hands of a dangerous, egocentric dictator is not a threat simply to the American government. It's a threat, really, to the stability of the economy of the world. So I think that although there is this tradition of suspicion of the American government on the part of the people, this is one occasion in which the American government really does have a completely clear conscience and clean hands.
You're the author of a book called War and the Liberal Conscience. I'll confess I haven't seen the book, but I was wondering if you could tell us what the central premise of the book is.
Well, it's a very good book, and I advise all of you to read it. It's published by Rutgers University Press. Go out and buy it at once. What it is about is the reaction of liberals, by which I mean people who believe in the perfectibility of man and who believe in self-government and who believe, ultimately, that all conflicts can be reconciled, how they react to war and how they have reacted over the past 200 years, and why it is that over and over again they have found it necessary or desirable to support wars.
Do you consider yourself fitting into that group that you describe as the liberal conscience?
Very, very much. And it has been a problem for me ever since I was a kid. This was really why I tackled that as a historian.
So you really were kind of instinctively opposed to war, but you found yourself getting behind certain wars?
Well, I was instinctively opposed to war. I was one of those generation which grew to maturity in the 1930s with the shadow of World War I heavily over. And the idea of another war seemed absolutely crazy and inconceivable. But by the time I grew up in the later 30s, it was clear that there was a war which had to be fought. And I then came to the conclusion that there were wars which had to be fought. And then started worrying about why are the wars which have to be fought and what are the criteria by which we do judge them. So, this has, in a way, been the story of my life.
Now, you fought in World War II. You were in the British Army in the Italian campaign from 1943 to 45. You were wounded twice. I'm wondering how that experience on a personal level affected your view of war and your interest in becoming a military historian.
Well, it affected my view of war to the extent that if one's involved in an earthquake, one gets rather interested in earthquakes. And I suppose that in the same way as some kid who's caught up in an earthquake might decide to become a seismologist, I decided to become a military historian. So it affected my view of war to that extent. But it also affected my understanding of war, of what it involves and how it's fought. And I remember sitting after a particularly horrible battle outside Salerno, in which dead and wounded were all around, and thinking, war is a realm of moral evil. Once you get involved in a war, you are involved in evil. You are committing it as well as suffering it. And therefore, anything which can be done to avoid getting involved in a war should be done. But nonetheless, ultimately, the bottom line is that you may have to.
My guest is Sir Michael Howard, a professor of military and naval history at Yale University. More with Howard in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll be hearing more details of the battle for Kafji, the little Saudi border town that was evacuated before the war, taken by the Iraqis for a while, and then retaken, it seems, by the Saudis. We'll have details of that and also whatever new is happening in the Gulf, including some reports of a big column advancing through southern Kuwait toward the Saudi border. And this evening, a special report not related to the Persian Gulf War, John Matteson's story about race relations at the workplace. It's a part one of a series of reports of a South African's view of race relations in America.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Sir Michael Howard is my guest. He's a professor of military and naval history at Yale University. I'm wondering what your reaction is to the sudden visibility and popularity of military historians and retired generals on all the network TV and cable TV now and analyzing the war.
Well, obviously, it's a boost for retired generals and for military historians. As being one of that ilk myself, I can't really complain about it. All I would warn you is not to overestimate the contribution which we can make. I'm desperately sorry if there's unfortunate retired generals who have to appear every night on CBS or somewhere and give instant comments to the news, because poor things. They are actually probably as bewildered and uncertain about it as we are. But still, I suppose they get a feed.
Now, in spite of what you just said about the difficult spot that all the retired generals are in, having to instantly analyze battles, do you have any impressions that you'd want to share about the significance of the battle yesterday at Kafji?
What I would say is it's not very significant. This is part of the problem of instant media news, that anything that happens at once is picked on and has to be analyzed. This was a minor skirmish, and I think that we'll probably see a lot more of them.
The Iraqi tanks crossed the Saudi Arabian border yesterday with their turrets turned, and that's a sign of surrender. And apparently when the Saudis came to accept the surrender, the Iraqis turned the turrets back around and started firing.
Well, you tell me it's a sign of surrender. I had never heard that in my life before.
Really? This is what I've been reading.
That is what I've been reading, and it is completely news to me. It was never regarded as such in Europe, so far as I know. Signs of surrender are absolutely clear. It is showing of white flags. If a convention has grown up somewhere that you turn your guns around to show that you're surrendering, it is not widely known.
So why do you think we're hearing this?
I think that there is always a tendency, A, to demonize the enemy and say he's cheating. And one's always got to be aware of that. And B, to give some explanation of why they did so well. One always tends to say, when one is defeated, unfair. They hit below the belt. They shouldn't have done it. They're nasty people. So I think immediately you would see people trying to explain why the Saudis ran away. Would say, they were deceived by the Iraqis. I don't buy that one for a single moment.
Are you having lively debates in your classes now? I wonder how your classes are being affected by the war.
I very firmly in my classes make them stick to what they're supposed to learn, but we're having lively debates outside.
Sir Michael Howard is a professor of military and naval history at Yale University. Today is our intern Sam Lynch's last day with us. We thank him for all the good work he's done. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, veteran Middle East reporter Thomas Friedman discusses why Israel and the Palestinians have never been able to make peace. And we talk with two Kuwaiti professors who were part of the resistance when Iraq invaded their country. They escaped and are now living in exile in the U.S. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.